Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. The Deep Dive is an in-depth discussion about issues in the news and in our daily conversations. On the program, we try and present insights, stories, and perspectives you might not hear anywhere else. Our new shows air every Thursday at 9 on KVON 1440, and you can always listen to past shows on Apple Podcasts, your favorite podcast app, and on the station's website, kvon.com. I'm happy to hear from you and especially welcome your suggestions on future discussions and possible guests. You can email us at deepdiveshow@winedownmedia.com. That's W-I-N-E, Winedown Media. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Deep Dive Show. You can also like us on our Facebook page, Deep Dive Show. We have two great guests today. First up, Kevin Fagan, a reporter and longtime journalist, but best known for his work with the San Francisco Chronicle on issues affecting the homeless. And then in the second part of the show, we talk to political strategist Tim Miller, a Republican on an island with very few people. He's a what you would call a never-Trumper, but one of the sharpest political minds I know. So first up is Kevin Fagan. Kevin is a longtime reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he has a passion, I think it's fair to say, for ferreting out stories that other people might not find. He is best known for his work covering the homeless, and indeed, for a number of years, Kevin was the only reporter in the United States whose beat was homelessness. I've worked with Kevin many times. He's a great reporter. He's a great musician, which I'm sure he would want me to plug. And Kevin, you, first of all, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate it. Thanks for kind words.
So
Kevin, I am passionate about homelessness, that's for sure.
So Kevin is a very hard-working dude, and about the only way we could get him was in his car on the way to cover another story. So I'm really appreciative that you could take the time and stay focused on the road, okay?
You bet. I'll try.
So, Kevin, you've covered a bunch of stories. You covered the 9/11 attacks. You covered Columbine. You've covered the Wine Country fire, the ghost ship fires. How does this COVID-19 story compare among all the kind of crises and disasters that you've covered?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm a disaster specialist in my career, and this was the worst. It's the worst in several different ways. And the main one is that it affects absolutely everyone. Your typical disaster, you go in, you know, I've airdropped in all over the country for disaster stories, and you're there for 3 days, maybe a week. And then you have some sporadic follows as the months go by, but you're kind of done after a couple of weeks, even on a catastrophic fire, although we cover them more intensely, given the national. You go on for months, and it's already gone on for months. And the other element of it is that there are always people who are affected in the disaster zones as they're covering it. Like at Santa Rosa Press Democrat, all those folks were in the fire zone when they were covering it.
Right.
Oakland Tribune, I was in the earthquake in 89. We were bashed the hell out of all of us. And so it gives an added urgency and passion or panic for some people. I mean, but this has everyone. I'm affected by myself, this thing. I specialize in homelessness, and I love to talk to homeless people, hang out with people, and I'm a guy who people and touches and shakes. So I've been in my house a few sojourns out into the world. I try to time them maybe once a week where I go do a whole lot of interviews, keep a lot of distancing, but try not to bring COVID back to my house because I have vulnerabilities in my house and in myself. It's like taking my life into my hands every time I go out. I've had one friend die of this disease, another one on a ventilator weeks. And that's just me. Everyone around us, journalist or not, is affected by this, and it weighs on the entire country, on the entire world, and you can feel that as you're reporting it. That is very different. And you feel the tragedy and the death and the pain in a way that I don't, it's
ubiquitous.
It's, and I'm trying to think, a call of mine high, that almost affected me terribly because it was the first big mass shooting of kids. And seeing those kids and their friends and the memorials, I mean, I cried the whole time I covered that thing. It was awful. The quake, the fires, where you're talking to people who lost grandmas and sons and fathers and wives and whatnot. It's that breaks your heart. This thing is a continuous heartbreak, and we're not even able to spend as much time to the victim families as we usually do because there's so damn many of them.
Well, you and know, I'll tell you, the sequestered. You know, you and I share this in common, is that we both are drawn to crises and disasters in our professional lives. And the thing that I've noticed about this one that makes it so, I mean, not only is it ubiquitous and unavoidable, this is the first crisis I've ever witnessed of this scale where the people at the top don't seem interested in bringing it to an end. They don't seem interested in solving the problems, which is an assumption you always make when you have a big earthquake or an environmental disaster or a mass shooting, is that the people who are running the show want to resolve the crisis and get back to some semblance of normalcy. And what I'm afraid of here is that that assumption is just, you can't assume that anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, as a reporter, I'm not supposed to weigh in with opinions, but...
You can have an opinion. Absolutely. You just have to be objective, right, in your stories.
Yeah. Yeah, objectively speaking, and observing, there have been kind of a national seen their disasters, and as a citizen, it's kind of distressing. On the statewide level, I see more active action. The trouble that I have this disaster, there is not a clip forward. Right. The underlying tension.
Right.
In a fire, you say, okay, we're going to go. Earthquake, same thing. Shooting, yeah. You right. know, and you have your usual fight over gun afterwards. But
you bring it to a close. Everybody wants to bring it to a close.
Yeah, you bring it to a close.
So let me ask you this. You know, I talk from time to time with your Uber boss, Audrey Cooper, who I'm happy to say has come and taught my class a few times at USF, as have you. And one of the more interesting things is watching your newspaper evolve into a virtual newsroom. Did you ever think you'd see the day when you would not have a newsroom to go to report the news?
I didn't. And I have to say, I do not like it. I like being in a team. I did freelancing early in my career. Wasn't a fan because you're just sitting around in your kitchen.
In your PJs.
Typing away. Yeah, some people like that. That's not me. I mean, I can certainly, I don't mind doing, you know, stories away from the office while I'm, you know, in the writing process or whatever. But I like going back to the command ship.
Back to the beehive.
I miss my friends. And I miss being able to consult on a story where you can just walk over to Joe Schmo's desk and say, you know, this guy isn't answering back. Where do you think we should go with this story? Or, I also have been an editor at the Chronicle, and I still sub in quite a bit as one. And I like being able to walk over to a reporter and say, hey, where do you think we're going to be doing with this angle? What do you have going on? It's an interactional relationship that is really not, you can't redo it.
There's no
with
substitute.
Slack and email. And
yeah.
I mean, my God, I've got this, my Slack channel has 50 freaking entries on it. And then I have 200 emails every day, and I get dozens of text messages, and some sources contact me on Facebook direct message. It's the virtual world is not as good a world.
No, it's not. I mean, it's, and you and I are fortunate in that we can transition to the virtual world where, you know, I think every day about people who just don't have that luxury. You know, if you drive a bus or if you, you know, if you work in a field or something like that, you cannot do that work remotely. And I think it's important to just remember that that's a huge part of our, you know, of our population. right,
yeah, so I feel very lucky that we can do that. It's so, you know, I'm complaining. It's like they say, first world problem.
Right. Good. I want to turn to your area of expertise, which is the homeless. You know, California, as we all know, is ground zero. We have, I think, 150,000 homeless people, which represents a very large jump, even in the last 10 years. I read a report yesterday from a professor at Columbia University who said that this population could grow to 180,000 or more because of recession and unemployment. Do you believe that we're going to see an explosion in the number of homeless because of the COVID crisis?
Well, it's interesting. There's no crystal ball on that. The expectation is, yes, there will be some new numbers of homeless people. But here's the silver lining in this really crummy cloud we have over all of us. Real estate is going to decline. It's going to prices are going to drop, and there will be a lot of properties available for governments to buy up to use as shelters and supportive housing. It's counterintuitive, but the experts I've been talking to for a story I'm putting together to run in June are telling me that as awful as all of this is, there may be a chance to acquire motels that are being occupied right now for homeless people and other distressed properties to turn into this kind of housing or shelter. The motels and hotels, the lower end ones in particular, even after the homeless people stop staying in them, some of them will be desperate for customers because the whole economy is not going to open up fully until we have a vaccine. Right. That's what I'm hearing. And they may be really happy to lease themselves out or sell their buildings to government to get a steady income and ready money. So that's the convoluted silver lining in all this that may stem the incoming rush of homeless people. The other thing is that in evictions, that's one of the great fears, is that once the eviction moratoriums drop off, you're going to get waves of people hitting the streets. Well, when you get evicted, if you're low income, you generally don't hit the streets right away. You stay with family, you got subsidies, there are programs, there are churches.
Well, you have a little bit of protection, too, from getting kicked out, you know, like tomorrow.
I'm sorry, say that again, Larry?
I said you have some protection, certainly in California, from just being kicked out tomorrow. You have a little bit of time, right,
to
maybe get things in order. Yeah.
And there's some nice proposals up. One of them that shows a lot of promise is a statewide proposal to let people pay their back rent over 10 years, you know, spread it out. Because if you're, you know, if you're a swinging a hammer somewhere and you haven't been able to work or punch in a register and you get a rent moratorium for 3 months, how are you going to pay 3 months back rent when you finally, you know, on a paycheck you haven't been getting? So that has to take some creative thinking and some government funding.
Yeah, I would imagine most people, forget paycheck to paycheck, you know, just knowing what I know about people and saving, I imagine most people would not be able to pay 3 months back rent, you know, even if you're making a pretty decent living, right?
So yeah. And especially if you're low income, 40% of the country lives paycheck to paycheck.
I know.
I think nearly half can't come up with $400 in a pinch.
So one of the things I've noticed about COVID is that it has made a lot of things that we previously thought unthinkable, and it's made them very real, right? I mean, you see clean air in a lot of cities that have not seen clean air in a long time. People talk about the homeless issue as something that we are finally paying attention to. It seems not just like an intractable, impossible problem, but did it take a public health crisis to force us to confront the homeless issue?
I think it escalated it, sure. There was a lot of attention to it before. It's the number one concern of most big cities. But yeah, you got a point. And that's one thing, another, you know, silver lining, if you will. A lot of people are observing in the homeless world, well, hey, when we had to move, we moved pretty fast.
Right.
It's not as fast as a lot of people, you know, still want. There are many advocates that would like to see every homeless person in a hotel room. That's probably not going to happen. But a lot of stuff got done very quickly. And that encourages people to believe that maybe after things open up, we can move that quickly again. Of course, the caveat is that there will be huge deficits in every government from one end of the state to the other.
Right.
But you're right. It's and the thing is that that what drove that is that in the homeless population, it's generally believed that COVID is rampant because people don't distance well. A lot of people are in distress, and they have more things on their minds than following rules about social distancing and whatnot. Being out in the open air kind of helps. You go to a place like the Tenderloin in San Francisco where it's just cheek to chow. You can bet there's a lot of disease running around in there. It's very sad.
You wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle about one shelter in San Francisco that had 100 infected people in it, and none of them showed symptoms. So the question is, what kind of a challenge do traditional homeless shelters pose right now in trying to arrest the spread of COVID?
Oh, it's terrible. The all of them of note have spaced themselves out by half. And this is pretty radical thing to do at a time when every shelter in the state was trying to increase capacity. Every jurisdiction of any size in the state was trying to put up new shelters and stack them in. Now you have to thin them out by half. It's radical and it's jarring, but people pivoted to it fairly quickly. And having the hotel rooms to put people into helped, because you had a relief valve. But once those hotels close, it's a huge challenge. What are you going
to
do?
We're talking to Kevin Fagan, a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle who specializes in homeless issues. Kevin, I've been looking at the numbers in Los Angeles, which has an even more intense homeless challenge than we do in the Bay Area. The mayor, Eric Garcetti, said that they have never, in the history of Los Angeles, they have never moved this many people at once. They've moved something like 6,000 people into 40 different shelters. What are the numbers looking like in San Francisco? And do you feel like San Francisco has, that it's a success story thus far?
It's a success story with context. A lot of the advocates are unhappy that there aren't more people inside. You have 5,000 people living outside. Mm-hmm. It's unsheltered, as they say, and a total of, another 3,500 or so in various forms of shelter. You don't have 5,000 people in the hotels. You got about, anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500. Mm-hmm. And that's not ideal, but it's enormously expensive. Tens of millions of dollars every month to put people into hotels at a time when the city is facing a $2 billion deficit. And all across the Bay Area, you have about 30,000 homeless people. That's a lot of people. That's a small city. And so suddenly housing a small city at a time when everyone's bleeding money government-wise is a lot to ask.
Well, and you know this better than most, there are a lot of homeless who feel that they're safer on the street than they are in a shelter, or who have for whatever reason, feel better about living about that option, among not such great options, but they want to be outside.
Yeah. There are a couple of different reasons for that. One is the main one that I discerned over the years, and I've slept in shelters as part of my research. People don't like being told what to do. They wake you up at 7, you have to eat breakfast with everyone else and line up
and then get out.
In
a lot of cases, right?
These days you can stay in the shelters, all day because they want you to be inside. But that means you're inside with people who are, most homeless people are in some sort of distress. And
right.
You have the occasional mental cases and drug cases. I get complaints. I'm getting complaints now. I'm in touch with a lot of people in shelters and on the streets by phone and internet, which a lot of homeless folks have phones. In some of the shelters, they're complaining because they're spending all day with some guy who's smoking meth in the bed next to him and starts screaming at 2 in the morning. It can be unpleasant. But sleeping out on the sidewalk, which I've done a lot of too, you never know where you get your teeth kicked in. You usually get all your stuff stolen. You get into fights with someone. And if you have an addiction, which many chronic homeless people do, when you run out of dope or the guy next to you runs out of dope, it gets ugly. It's best to be inside somewhere.
Well, the other thing that strikes me is that, a lot of homeless don't have the option of sheltering in place, of social distancing, of washing their hands. The things that we are telling people they have to do, you know, some of these things are a challenge in that population as well, right?
Oh yeah, totally. There are a lot of hand washing stations in place now in San Francisco.
Are they being used? Do you think people use them?
They use them, but not assiduously.
Yeah.
You know, they're not. There's not a whole lot of discipline on the street.
Yeah.
I'm at a homeless camp right now in Oakland, where there are lines and lines of tents right next to each other. They have not distanced 6 feet like you're recommended to do. The CDC says, leave camps outside, don't mess with them, but make them space 6 feet apart. I've seen very few camps in the Bay Area
People spend a lot of time making their home. I mean, it is their home, and, you know, they spend time building it up and putting stuff, you know, around it and keeping their stuff in it, you know. I mean, it is. So, you know, you're talking about Oakland. So I work, one of my clients is BACS, Bay Area Community Services, which a group I'm sure you know well. And the head of BACS, Jamie Almanza, says that even now, people are still not appreciating the magnitude of this crisis among the homeless population. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I would agree with that. A lot of people are sheltering in place. You know, especially the luckier ones like us who can work from home, and you're not driving around seeing the kind of ongoing chaos here in Oakland. Across the street from the biggest shelter in downtown Oakland, I'm about a block away from it right now. It's entirely covered with a tarp that the folks living there in the camp there have put up. Talk about a containment zone for the virus. Mm. I mean, everyone sleeping inside there is going to get infected if they bring it in, which undoubtedly someone has. You walk through some parts of the Mission or in the Tenderloin in particular, and people are just right next to each other. No masks, coughing and breathing. And homeless people I talked to who were trying to stay safe, they don't like that. And the ones who are walking around without masks, and you have a conversation with them and say, "What are you doing?" They say, "I'm outside. I'm kind of screwed anyway.
Right.
You're gonna let it rip." I don't think most people who aren't homeless or don't have to drive around in those heavily impacted areas are aware of that severity. If that disease goes rampant in the street population, the feeling is that it just continues to insert itself into the rest of the population as well.
Right.
So it's not healthy for it's not healthy for civilization to have people, you know, so poor they're living outside and unprotected, and it just keeps things spreading around.
So I know you're chasing a story. I have just a couple more questions for you. Very interesting story in San Francisco over this issue of safe sleeping sites. The idea of using parkland for organized encampments. What's the status of safe sleeping sites?
Oh, the feeling is that they will be employed in bigger numbers. Right now, there is one safe sleeping site next to the main library, just a block away from City Hall, and it's big. It's spaced out. It used to have a ton of people cheek to jowl just who chose to camp there anyway. Now the city has organized it and put in hand washing stations, bringing in food. It's a better alternative than letting people just do it themselves, because it's not organized when you do it that way. There are going to be more of those. And generally the feeling is that it'll be on wide open lots or empty fields rather than in, you know, say Golden Gate Park. That was a point of contention. A lot of people didn't want, you know, people next to the Conservatory of Flowers, they're putting up tents. That was the imagery. But there are plenty of lots, especially on Portland. There are some piers that are wide open and can be used. And one of them got used for RVs and trailers. And it's lovely. I was just out there last week. It's a good thing. In fact, that RV trailer site out there in the Bayview, that's the first real shelter they've had in a long time, and the trailers and RVs are new. They're from the state generally. The city bought some, and the hope out there is that, well, they can keep them after this crisis lays down, and that way they'll have better sheltering options out in that kind of neglected corner of the city that has a huge homeless population.
Well, and maybe people can feel like it's actually home, like they can lock the door, they can have a little privacy, they can, you know, keep their food. So
well, absolutely.
So yeah. People who are listening to this can't see this, but I noticed that you are putting on gloves.
I am.
Some surgical gloves. getting ready to go out and report our next great homeless story. So, Kevin Fagan, I can't thank you enough for taking a few minutes and being on the deep dive with us, and I hope you'll come back.
Thanks, Larry. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for doing the show. It's a smart thing you're doing, and I appreciate it.
All right. Stay well, my friend.
Okay, you too. Talk to you.
Bye. I want to turn our attention to national politics now and to one of the sharpest interpreters I know, Tim Miller. Tim is a contributor to a publication called The Bulwark. He's a communications consultant and served in communications roles for Jeb Bush, for the Republican National Committee, and for our Principles PAC, which I think is fair to say is an anti-Trump PAC. So... And Tim wrote a really terrific piece with video in the Bulwark called The 10 Weeks That Lost the War, a timeline of how Trump lied, bungled, and screwed America in the COVID-19 crisis. So, Tim, thank you. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to do it. Appreciate that.
All right, Tim. So it's late May. We're in the middle of a pandemic that has killed in excess of 90,000 people. We don't expect a vaccine for this till next year. It leaves us with these very blunt, primitive tools like working from home and social distancing. We have a president who, against all advice, claims he's taking a potentially dangerous drug. He's threatening to withdraw from the WHO, and he's blaming China for this illness. Fast forward, how do you think you're going to be able to describe this time to your grandkids?
Well, as the great George W. Bush said after Trump's inauguration speech, I think it's some pretty weird stuff. I guess it's the PG version of what W. had said after the inauguration. It's extremely unusual. I think that there is these sort of weird bubbles that we're all living in, where you have kind of your media bubble where you're just taking in this insane president that is so far beyond the pale of what we could have imagined. Even those of you listeners who, unlike me, are not fond of W and kind of thought he was an idiot, or older listeners who thought Reagan was a doofus actor or whatever, I don't think that even their worst image of Reagan or W was even kind of within the same ballpark of the clownishness and buffoonishness of this current president. And so to think that he would be overseeing at the same time another crisis that is, 100-year public health crisis and an economic crisis, it's hard to wrap your head around. And I think that, while the pain of this is very acute for certain people, there's also this tension that's going on where there are big pockets of the country where, the pain isn't that acute, right? And it feels forced upon them. And so, it's kind of hard to translate between all, three, all of these worlds, right? The kind of political media entertainment world and then the real, life impact, and what is happening on, the families of 90,000 people, the families of those who can't work from home, have lost their jobs and are living paycheck to paycheck.
Well, and it's
the rest of us.
And I think it's a mistake to get sucked into this kind of partisan divide that if you want to see business opened up and travel opened up, that you're somehow, with the know-nothings. I mean, I really do sympathize, with people who want to get out of their house and who want to get away from their kids for at least a few hours a day. that doesn't make them bad people. But I think, you know, we want to look at this through kind of a dichotomy that, you know, you're either for social distancing or you're against it. You know, it's like a political divide.
And this was a long time coming, right? But Trump was just kind of like the Kool-Aid man jumping through the wall, and he's just sort of ripped this kind of partisan cultural divide, you know, that had been starting to fray for a while now in half. And it makes any national issue like that. I mean, you can. There's almost this kind of alternative universe that's happening right now at the state level with governors. Right, we're like, you can imagine a different political universe where my old boss Jeb had won, or where Hillary had won. Maybe not Hillary. She would have, I think, caused the right to go insane during this time. But you know, Martin O'Malley would have won. And where, you know, these issues haven't overlapped with the culture wars, right? I mean, you've got Jared Polis in Colorado, who is, you know, been one of the more aggressive governors at opening, and he's done it in really smart ways. You know, thought about creative ways to open up Colorado, which is my home state. You know, you've got some of these more my types of people, the anti-Trump Republicans who are left, you know, Larry Hogan's in Maryland and Charlie Baker's in Massachusetts, right? Who are you know, trying to like think creatively and how to deal with the you know, pretty bad outbreaks in their state. So, you know, like at that level, you can kind of see how this could work, but that's just not possible right now on the national stage. And when you get into this insane world that we live in, where you know hydroxychloroquine is a litmus test, a medicine is a partisan signal now. Like if you're for hydroxychloroquine working, you're a Republican. If you're against it, you're a Democrat. And then it's the inverse on vaccines. You know, if you're for Bill Gates coming up with a vaccine, you're a Democrat. And if you're skeptical of Bill Gates' vaccines, you're a Republican. And this is deeply unhealthy for us to have let the kind of public health questions get tied up into these, you know, Trumpian culture war questions.
Yeah. Well, and I'm afraid that a lot of my Democratic brethren and certainly a lot of folks in the media are all too willing, you know, to jump into that reflex. And, you know, because it takes two to tango. If you're going to make hydroxychloroquine some kind of signal, you know, that goes both ways.
For sure. I mean, those press briefings, thank goodness they're finished, were absurd. And I wrote about this for Rolling Stone. I wrote about kind of the Kayleigh McEnany press conferences and Trump's press conferences during this time. And I wrote about how they've become performance art. So it's like the WWE now, you know, and our old friend Joe Lockhart wrote me about that and said he was press secretary for Clinton, for those who don't know. And he said that he wanted to write the story, but felt it was too self-serving. So he was happy I did. But, you know, back in the old days, press secretaries spun. You know, presidents spun. You tried to, even in crisis, you tried to paint the best picture of what was happening with your administration. But there was this kind of baseline respect that, you know, particularly in times of crisis, that information needed to be factual, that the public needed to know, you know, at least, you know, your best version of the truth. And, you know, then there were reporters there to kind of poke holes at what, you know, where you might have been coloring the truth, where you might have been overstepping the line. It wasn't a perfect system. There were people that abused it, no doubt. But it was far better than what we have now, which is Trump and Kayleigh, who don't care at all about the truth and aren't even, you know, they're not even starting the spin of their answers with what is right and how do I make this look good. It's like, what's the best thing I can just say? Who cares whether or not it's true? And, you know, and then on top of that, you know, the deeply inappropriate, like personal ad hominem attacks on their opponents in the media. And then the media plays their role with, asking, you know, questions that they know that they're going to lie about, or asking, you know, very reality TV style questions of the president. If you're CNN or MSNBC, performative questioning, where you're not trying to get to a real answer, you're just trying to show off the question. And then Fox or OAN will have their performative question about how great the president's doing. And then we leave the briefing 2 hours later and nobody's learned anything, you know, unless
but a lot of people are riled up. But a lot of people get riled up.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is, it has become a complete farce. And, And, you know, that is not, you know, it has done nothing to advance, you know, solving this crisis. But I don't think it's, you know, from the media's perspective, it's not done, they haven't done anything to help inform their viewers about what's really happening, with some exceptions. But there's a lot of play acting happening.
You alluded to, you know, how the soil has kind of been ready for a long time for what's going on now. There's a piece that I think I'm sure you've read. I think everybody in our little world has read from the Irish Times from a couple of weeks ago. And the headline was, "The world has loved, hated, and envied the U.S. Now, for the first time, we pity it." And one of the lines in that article really stood out to me, especially, you know, as somebody who's worked in crisis, as have you. He says, "It's one thing to be powerless in the face of a natural disaster, quite another to watch vast power being squandered in real time." What does this say about, I mean, this goes beyond Trump and his personality and his bad habits, right? So what does this kind of say to you about where we are and kind of what, you know, what this, what that soil has looked like?
And we're not a country right now that's really able to solve big problems. You know, I mean, there are bottom up ways that we can solve big problems, you know, and we can talk about some of those, some examples in the private sector or in, you know, volunteerism and areas where individuals have made big change in the past 20 years. But since 9/11, I don't think anybody looks at the government. I guess Obama's initial handling of the financial crisis was bad politically, but looked pretty deft as an economic solution. But besides that, like, you really can't point to anything. There haven't been, you know, big problems aren't being solved. If you look at the Bush administration, they didn't even pass any big legislation after like 2003.
Yeah.
You know, the second tax cut. Obama, same way. You know, they jammed a lot in that first 100 days, and then Obama, like, really didn't do any. That was what the whole pen in the phone thing was about, because he couldn't get anything passed. Right? They didn't do anything for the last 6 years of his administration.
But you think that's institutional, or do you think that's a comment on Obama or Bush personally?
I think it's institutional. I mean, I think that in retrospect, probably, if you look at both of them, probably look back and say, oh, Obama's like, maybe I could have cut that deal with Boehner when I had the chance really early before things got so toxic. Or maybe there were things I could have done more aggressively in those first 100 days had I known how bad it was going to be in the last 9. You know, I think you can nitpick, and surely there's plenty of things to pick W on that, you know, certainly maybe W could have accomplished more had we not gotten into the Iraq quagmire. You know, so certainly they both are flawed. But institutionally, the point I was saying is that institutionally we're not set up in Washington to solve big problems. It's not, there aren't any great examples of things from, you know, people in previous generations can look to, you know, from all, you know, the great things that happened in this country, but from the 30s, you know, forward, and then the post-World War II era. I mean, you know, you can tick off every decade some of the great accomplishments of the country. We just, those aren't happening anymore. And so part of the reason is kind of the sclerotic institutional nature of our government has gotten out of control. But a big part of it is that we have now, you know, the political divide has gotten so great that it prevents, you know, any of the comedy that is necessary. Comedy, not comedy. There's plenty of comedy that is necessary. Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's very little comedy of the second sort.
Yeah, macabre, I guess.
Yeah.
But comedy. But, you know, there's knowing the incentive structures have changed, you know, thanks to the changes in the media, changes in the electorate, changes in how outside in money in politics, how that works. And you know, all of these little changes have resulted in, you know, a government that is just basically incapable of doing anything, and where each individual in this show is incentivized only to, you know, feed the most extreme rhetoric to their base and get the most retweets and get the most low dollar fundraising dollars in. It's a vastly different environment. than it was,
yeah.
you know, when I came to Washington 20 years ago. And so, you know, Trump is obviously has unique problems that we add that we get to layer on top of those structural problems.
Well, you were talking about going to Washington. I mean, you made your reputation as I guess I would call you a pre-Trump GOP or pre-Trump Republican. You know, like a lot of us, you started off as an itinerant campaign staffer, and then ultimately you worked for people like McCain and Bush and the RNC. I guess first I'd ask you, do you still consider yourself a Republican?
That's a good question, because I don't really have I haven't been asked this. Every time I go, you know, to do cable punditry now, they ask me this because, you know, you need to have a chyron. It's like, are you still a Republican strategist? I'm like,
well like Steve Schmidt gets identified as, you know, ex-Republican strategist, right?
Ex-Republican strategist, yeah. Right? Like, what is your... And the answer to me for that is, I think it's... I'm certainly not a Republican in good standing. I'm not a Democrat, though, and I think that despite the fact that I am deeply alienated from my party, I think that there's value in fighting for it. I would tell you that I think my trajectory is towards not being a Republican. I don't have much hope for a post-Trump Republican Party rebound, but I do think there's value in fighting the internal fight. I wish he had had a primary. I was ready to be a part of a primary campaign if he had had a credible one. I tried to recruit some candidates that I thought would have been good. I think they would have lost, but I think that somebody could really lay the groundwork for an alternate vision for a future of the Republican Party that would have been valuable even in defeat. So, you know, if that emerges, I'm open to it. But no, I think I'm on a quick trajectory towards being not a Republican. And I think if you ask any actual Republicans, if somebody who voted for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden is a Republican, they would laugh at your face. So
what is...
That's a very the short answer, which is, yeah, probably not.
Well, let's get specific. I mean, what in 2020, what should the Republican Party be about? And how does it ever get to that place?
I think that in my kind of wonderful imaginary world, I think that you know, there's a Democratic Party right now that is increasingly, you know, with the exception of this last primary, which I think has some interesting, there's some interesting reasons if you want to get into that, why Joe Biden won despite being at the more at the center of the party.
Right.
But I see a party that the trajectory of which is moving to the left in a significant way, moving to the left in a way that I'm a little bit concerned has this is an overheated word, so I don't mean that I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders would be a totalitarian, but I think it has an anti-democratic streak,
yeah.
On the left, a streak that is not as interested in some of the fundamental American ideals when it comes to freedom of speech and other things of that nature when it comes to free markets. I think that there's a turn away from that on the left. So I would love to see a healthy Republican Party that is a check on that, that is something that fosters you know, these sort of bottom-up innovations that have been so successful in America, something that focuses, you know, more on, you know, how can we take a really old, out-of-date, sclerotic government that, as I said earlier, hasn't done anything in a quarter century and reorganize it in a way that looks more like, you know, what successful companies in 2020 look like, rather than, you know, looking like a big bloated version of the New Deal government. I think that it's okay for there to be a populist streak in the Republican Party on, you know, creative things like, you know, basic income. You know, you read some of this and you say the Republican Party does have to be a party for working class white people that have been out of, you know, been disaffected by globalism. I get that, but I don't think the answer to that is, you know, racism and bigotry is closing the border, is shutting down ourselves from the world. Like, I think that there should be other creative 21st century solutions to help
people
hollowed out town.
And
that's,
you know,
what I wish the party was about, but it seems to me that the party is moving more towards being basically a party of white grievance, a culturally conservative big government party, and one that recedes us from the world rather than engages with the world. And I think that Trump has you know, will leave that mark on the party for a little while.
Do you expect to vote for Joe Biden?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Man, I was worried you guys were going to make it tough on me for a little while with Bernie. I guess I would have held my nose and covered my eyes and voted for him. Not like my vote really matters in California, but that would have made it really, that would have made it a tough one. But Trump is so far beyond the pale. And I think that there were a lot of people of goodwill and good intention last time in 2016 who didn't like either candidate and threw their vote away.
Yeah.
And those people were decisive, unfortunately. And if you just look at the data, I think that Hillary, you know, there's a lot of talk about the, you know, white working class voters that left Hillary, the voters who didn't turn out, younger voters, voters of color who didn't turn out. All that is true. But she only lost by 70,000 votes.
And yeah. Thanks, Jill Stein.
Yeah, if you just look at Jill Stein voters, if you just look at the Gary Johnson voters, who are a lot of people like me, who are alienated by both parties and were like, threw their vote away, you know, Hillary could have won with those people. So I think it's important to recognize that while Joe Biden is not somebody that I imagined I would be voting for when I was working at the Republican National Committee 8 years ago, I not only will be voting for him, but I will be doing so enthusiastically.
Has his campaign reached out to you?
I talked to some of the communications people on the campaign from time to time. I don't think that I want to go. I don't want to move to Philadelphia and go. I guess is he even going to have a campaign office anymore? So I don't know. I'm not sure that I actually want to work for Joe Biden. But I'm happy doing. I'm happy what I'm doing, writing, and I think I'll be. We've got some schemes up our sleeves for some Republicans for Biden projects that we might be doing on the outside. So I'll be able to hopefully help them that way.
I can assure you, having grown up in Philadelphia, that you definitely don't want to be there as the summer months are looming. All right, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about Biden for just a second. I mean, I'm interested in your thought on his path to victory and his path to defeat. You know, there's this school that says there are disaffected Republicans and, you know, Democrats who voted for Trump, who he can get back. There's a theory that says you have to really rile up, you got to get out the heavy artillery and rile up the Democratic Party, the base, especially some of the more reliable voting blocks like African Americans. Which do you think is the more credible path to victory?
I think the first one. I understand the second school of thought is the ascendant school of thought in both parties right now, that the presidential politics are base mobilization efforts. And I was wrong about this in 2016, so maybe I'll be wrong again. In 2016, I did not believe that there were enough white voters who did not, in the pool of voters to help Trump with, you know, the loss that he was going to take among voters of color. That was incorrect. I mean, it turned out that there was a very large pool of non-college white voters who traditionally didn't vote that were able to turn out and voted for the first time for him, the first time in a while.
Yeah.
Obama, obviously, that was Obama's path. So the last three, and it was really Bush's, certainly in the re-elect, I think that might be probably not 2000. I think people have misremembered 2000. But so the last four presidential elections, the president has won on the latter strategy, which is the base mobilization. So I understand there's a lot of eye rolls and nervousness when I tell you that Joe Biden should go back to the old strategy, which is working in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think here's why. Part of it is, you know, this thing is like a rubber band. We've been stretching it out to both sides with the base mobilization strategy for a while now. And eventually that the rubber band breaks because there's just not enough pull there. Secondly, I think that there's been a reorganization of the parties over the past 5 years that impacts Biden's strategy. Like, there's been this big influx of suburban voters in the middle into the Democratic Party. Some of them used to be swing voters. Some of them used to be like me. They're Republicans who are disaffected. If you look at where the turnout came from in the Democratic primary, there was a big turnout juice, that it wasn't from the base, it wasn't from black voters in the cities, it wasn't from young voters like Obama did it, it was in the suburbs, it was moderate voters. In every state, in Iowa, it was in the Des Moines exurbs, in South Carolina, it was in the Charleston burbs, if you look at McLean, Virginia, Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas suburbs.
Kansas?
massive turnout, like three times more people this time than last time.
Yeah.
This huge surge. So it's a turnout play of a different kind, right? It's a moderate turnout play, and I think that's where Biden's you know wins this election. I think that he also, you know, just needs to cut the margins down among the white working class Obama Trump voters. I don't, you know, this is not a play to win those folks back, but it's just like win 20% of them back. You know, that's the ball game. Like, you know, this is not a way to win those voters. And then I think that, you know, it is important to focus on African-American turnout in Milwaukee and in Detroit and Philly. I think there was some drop off there. Part of that was, I think Hillary didn't excite those voters. Part of it was, I think people assumed Trump was going to lose. I think there was a little bit of a laziness with that. So that's his path, I think. Juicing the suburban turnout, cutting down margins just a little bit with the white working class turnout, and then juicing margins just a little bit in the cities. I don't think that young liberals are part of that. If they want to, there just aren't enough of them to matter. If they want to throw their vote away to whoever this time is, Jill Stein is, like, pandering to them, the math doesn't work there. People on Twitter don't like to hear this, but like the benefit, the increase in votes that Joe Biden gets by going hard for the Green New Deal with AOC, with these young liberals, is not as much as the votes he could lose in all three of those other categories by doing that.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, my reference point in politics was Vietnam and Watergate, right? So, you know, that's when I kind of came of age and got involved in politics. And I thought that people who cared, you know, if you really cared, you had to get involved in politics to keep another Nixon administration from happening. Nixon looks pretty damn benign by comparison. But in 74, you know, the Democrats expanded they already had a majority in Congress. They expanded it. And then in 76, the end of the Nixon administration, really, with Ford, they took the White House. But the thing I want to focus on is what happened after that, which is we just saw reform after reform after reform to kind of counteract Nixon's abuses. Do you think the same thing could happen? Let's say Trump loses in 2020. Let's say you have a more Democratic presence in D.C. Do you think we'll see an era of the pendulum swinging back, a more heavily reform-oriented Congress, or do you think they're just too dysfunctional?
I'm worried they're too dysfunctional. I think that there is a hesitancy to want to take power away from the executive. Look at the Democratic campaign platforms. I mean, Biden is probably the most likely person of all them to try to put in place some reforms. But I think he'll get a lot of pressure for his left to focus on economic and environment reforms, such as healthcare reforms, which all have value. But Kamala, Bernie, Warren, like, these people are all running on very strong executive platforms. I'm with you. I wish that there was this, you know, grand eye opening to the value of Republican, small R Republican politics and pluralism, and that, you know, we need to limit the power of the executive and, you know, empower Congress. I just don't see any evidence that that's the case, and that Trump has scared anybody. I think that there's this feeling on the left that doesn't matter what they do, what reforms they put forth, the Republicans just cheat. So screw them. So we should cheat back. I mean, that's the sense I get when I hear from my Democratic friends, when I go on Democratic podcasts and such. The feedback I get is more, we need to play more hardball like them.
We had my wife and I had a discussion about this just this morning in response to the morbidly obese comments that and the plump Trump or President Plump hashtag that Nancy Pelosi has kind of instigated. My wife she's very much a, you know, they go low, we go high kind of person. And I'm a little more, I'm a little more willing to get into the gutter because I'm not sure. I think that's what Trump understands, a 2x4 to the side of the head. He understands somebody calling him a name. But I can't say I'm happy about that. You know, I can't say I'm happy to be feeling that, hey, I'm really glad that the Speaker of the House out insulted the President of the United States in the midst of a gigantic crisis that we're having. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I know. I'm of multiple minds on this one too. I very much don't think that we should let Trump contaminate the rest of us. You know, and so I think that having some, you know, thinking about that and giving that consideration of, you know, is Trump really, you know, just going to drag us all along with him and turn all of our politics into Trumpism forever? Mm-hmm. I'm worried about that. So I think having some checks on that is valuable. Throwing a hard punch at him is needed, though. You know, so it's one of those things where, I don't know. Here's an example. Rick Wilson is a guy that's a friend of mine. He's never another one of us few, the proud, the never Trumpers. And he went on CNN and made fun of Trump supporters and did like a fake Southern yokel accent and
his own basket of deplorables.
Yeah, and I was asked about that, and I said I love Rick, but I don't think that the answer for Trumpism is just to use his tactics against him. So I was uncomfortable with the Pelosi thing. Sometimes Trump needs a taste of his own medicine, so I don't know. I'll make an exception for anything with it's Trump and his own family, but for the rest of them, I think that there's at least value in trying and hoping that when this is over, we can, you know, restore a little bit of decency. Though my optimism for that is pretty low.
Well, let's end on a more forward-looking note. You know, one of the things that I've been trying to, it's just so easy to get worked up and caught up in news that really doesn't educate you or help, you know, make the world a better place. All it does is gives you agita. So I am really trying to find places where we can really see positive change coming out of all this. So are there any ways in which you see politics and our country changing for the better as a result of this crisis?
Larry, this is the hardest question you could ask me. I don't know. I'm in a very pessimistic place these days. I did an interview with a New Yorker writer who interviewed all of the former Trumpers, and at the end of it, he was like, "Man, that was dark. The only guy darker than you is Romney strategist Stuart Stevens." And he's like, "I was worried about his health."
Yeah, that's only because he's older.
So, yeah, he's a little older. So I'm pretty. I'm pretty pessimistic. I think that, particularly in this crisis, there have definitely been, I mentioned this earlier, some green shoots in state government. And I think that the more the more divisive things get on a national level, the more important it is for things to happen on a local level. And I did worry for a while. I was thinking that national politics kind of had eaten everything, right? The old Tip O'Neill line was that all politics is local, and like now it's been the inverse of that for a while. Like everything is Trump, all politics is national. But I do think that there's a group called Run for Something.
Yes.
On the left that you know, then they're pushing, you know, people to get involved in their communities, to run for state house and state senate. The woman that runs that, I think, is super talented. And so I see things like that, and I think that this crisis is going to kind of remind people that local government matters, because they're like, oh man, I can't go to the store, go do what I want to do until my mayor or my governor says that I do, right? So like politicians have been off the radar for a lot of people who don't pay attention to politics are now very much on the radar. So I think that maybe, you know, local and state changes and getting people involved that way, and maybe some functional local and state governments can bubble up to our federal government, is probably the best piece of hope I got. But, you know, we keep things pretty dark at the Bulwark. So I think, you know, folks can see come read the other side of the coin there.
I read it pretty regularly, and, I would challenge that it's dark, and, some people characterize it as a conservative publication. I don't particularly read it that way. I mean, I think it's thoughtful and provocative in a way that doesn't make me sick. So, yeah. You know,
we're heterodox. And we try, it's basically, you know, all the writers are people who have been kind of expelled from some community or another. And I think we all have gives us the freedom to write honestly about what we think, because none of us are trying to angle for a job as Biden or Trump's White House press secretary. So I think it's been a cool project to work on.
Well, you can't.
So we've got some talented people there.
You can't angle for a job as a press secretary, because the press secretary's first and foremost job is to not ever lie to the press. I mean, how in the world could you do that job without that tool?
Yeah.
Hey, so Tim Miller, thank you very much. I always enjoy talking to you. I hope you and your family keep well, and we'll be looking forward to more good writing and commentary from you coming up.
Thanks, Larry. I hope the wineries open up soon for some outdoor distance things. I can come see you.
Okay.